We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences. So the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Just go to Indeed.com/Blue Wire right now and support our show by saying that you heard about Indeed on this podcast. That's Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This podcast episode is brought to you by Coors Light. These days, everything is go, go, go. It's nonstop hustle all the time. Work, friends, family expect you to be on 24/7. Well, sometimes you just need to reach for a Coors Light because it's made to chill. Coors Light is cold lagered, cold filtered, and cold packaged. It's as crisp and refreshing as the Colorado Rockies. It is literally made to chill. Coors Light is the one I choose when I need to unwind. So when you want to hit reset, reach for the beer that's made to chill. Get Coors Light in the new look delivered straight to your door with Drizzly or Instacart. Celebrate responsibly. Coors Brewing Company, Golden, Colorado.
Support for this podcast comes from U.S. Bank. When it's time for a new credit card, the best ones do way more than just buy stuff. And that's why U.S. Bank offers credit cards that make every day more rewarding. Earn cash back, score points when you shop, dine out, travel, or binge watch, or get a low intro APR. U.S. Bank credit cards were designed to fit your lifestyle. So make every day more rewarding and check out usbank.com/creditcard. U.S. Bank credit cards are issued by U.S. Bank National Association N.D. Some restrictions may apply. Member FDIC.
Welcome in to the RotoWire NFL podcast. John McKechnie joined by Mario Puig. We are back in the saddle here. We're going to be posting these every Wednesday from now up through the draft and potentially beyond. So, Mario, it's good to be kind of back hosting with you, man.
Yeah, it's been about, has it been 2 months already since the radio
stuff? Since the radio stuff? Yeah, it's been, that's pre-Stephon Diggs.
I'm doing so many important things that I can't remember anything like that, but I assure you I've gotten a lot done since then, however long it's been.
Oh, me too, totally. I've learned how to like cut up GIFs and stuff, so I mean, I'm really making progress.
Yeah, you did that, and I'm starting to make a table in Microsoft Word today, so I might get it done this week even.
There we go. Now we're talking. So we're cooking with heat here, obviously a couple of tech wizards, but we're also a couple of football guys, and we're going to be, again, getting you all set and ready for the draft every week through the lead up there. So I guess because we've been off air for a little bit, I wanted to just kind of catch everyone up. A little bit of off-season primer, the coaching carousel, and with free agency set to start in the middle of next month, I wanted to dive in with the coaching changes. First of all, I guess Arizona, we'll go a little bit alphabetical order to get us started here. So Bruce Arians is gone. Carson Palmer retired. So it's a very new look, different look, Arizona team heading into 2018. And we still don't really have a great idea of what is all going to come together as. What did you make of Steve Wilks, the former Panthers defensive coordinator, getting that job?
So he's another understudy of Ron Rivera. So like Sean McDermott was hired by Buffalo last year, Wilkes was leaving the same position that McDermott took, and I think you're going to see him try to do in Arizona what McDermott did in Buffalo, which is to say they go to that Ron Rivera defense where it's press-heavy 4-3. They kind of make a living with their pressure, live and die by the pressure. They got Marcus Golden and Chandler Jones playing the 4-3 end spots, if that is the case, so it should work pretty well on defense. The defense has a good amount of talent, and beyond that, it seems like he would be leaving the, he meaning Steve Wilkes, would be leaving the offense mostly to the control of Mike McCoy, who was fired from Denver, but it's hard to tell, you know, how much he could be blamed for how bad they were.
There's nothing you could do with that situation.
Right. So McCoy is going to be probably running that offense, and recent years with Phillip Rivers, I would say like he's been one of the slightly more pass friendly kind of coaches. So it'll be interesting to watch who they eventually take as quarterback. It could be a decent spot, especially if Fitzgerald's back. But yeah, Wilkes, you think, would switch them to a 4-3 defense. They've been running a mostly 3-4 type of approach as long as Bruce Arians has been there.
Okay. So their base set will be a little bit different on the defensive side of the ball. And then what we'll get into what they might want to do draft wise coming up a little bit later in the show, but overall relatively positive impression on the hire.
It's hard to tell because, I mean, Ron Rivera seems to at the very least prepare his understudies well. You know, whether it's, you know, his ideas or Rivera's that he's executing doesn't matter as long as it's working, and McDermott made it work. So maybe it's a sustainable model. And like I said, they got Chandler Jones and Marcus Golden. So they have the tools at least to make a good defense. But offense is a big question, obviously, with Palmer headed out.
Right. And, you know, the rest of that defense, you know, you mentioned the front seven, but there's obviously Patrick Peterson, Tyrann Mathieu as well. But
Deion Buchanan.
I think one of our sort of recurring themes throughout the NFL season, when we were doing the radio show, was what they have in that secondary outside of the, you know, those kind of household names. So they're probably going to need to be addressing that as well.
They need probably a second and third corner, okay, just as like a starting point. Yeah. But yeah, that's something that they might have to consider in the first round if they're not able to get a good enough quarterback option.
Yeah. So their needs are pretty clear cut. So it should be interesting to see where it goes from there. Let's move on to the Bears. This is one of those hires that, you'll have to educate me on this a little bit more. I'm always skeptical when everyone just really, really loves a hire, just sort of not necessarily out of nowhere, but, you know, always he like checks all the boxes for like your standard NFL hire that's always going to be lauded by the media types. It's like, oh, he's Matt Nagy. Like, he's been working under Andy Reid for so long, multiple spread, just using buzzwords to really just kind of talk about this guy. So, I mean, what's your impression? What's your expectation? What's the fit here?
Well, so Nagy is interesting if you believe that he can basically emulate what guys like McVay and Peterson have been doing. Like, he's supposed to be a sort of a newer breed sort of coach, not, you know, a dinosaur hire. He was particularly interesting because his the takeoff of the Chiefs offense last year coincided with the weeks that Andy Reid gave up play calling to Nagy. Mm-hmm. So that was a really good looking offense. They finally started going deep to Tyreek Hill. They did it pretty aggressively, actually, and it unsurprisingly worked a lot better than those endless drag routes they were running for the previous, you know, 22 weeks or whatever it was. And he's probably committed to an up-tempo approach based on the hiring of Mark Helfrich as offensive coordinator. Like, we know from his Oregon days that Mark Helfrich should not be allowed to like touch any buttons or anything.
This is bad. Yeah.
But what it shows is, like, I think Nagy at the very least wanted someone who would run up-tempo practices efficiently. And at the very least, Helfrich can do that. He conducted practices basically for Chip Kelly for however long he was the offensive coordinator under Kelly at Oregon. So he being there seems to at the very least indicate like Nagy's saying like, we're going to get your conditioning up and we're going to go no huddle. We're probably going to do a lot of ambitious motion formations, kind of like the Rams and the Eagles have and the Saints too. So I think it's a commitment to at least running a lot of plays and conducting an aggressive offense, which at the very least for fantasy purposes makes the Bears a sleeper for me. I like Trubisky kind of quite a bit given his rushing abilities.
Right. And, you know, I think, you know, there are some elements to Trubisky's game that are a little bit comparable to Alex Smith. I think you could probably say that his arm is a little bit better, but
yeah, much better.
In terms of like the, you know, the mobility factor, like the sort of underrated rushing yardage potential there. And obviously Trubisky a lot younger, you know, probably 10 years younger than Alex Smith.
He can withstand contact better than Smith too. So you might even see kind of like red zone run option concepts, run pass option concepts. Whereas with Smith, it was more like he scrambles to get away from the pressure and he can get away with that like 4 or 5 times a game. Like Trubisky can kind of, you know, get some rushing touchdowns perhaps in fantasy.
Okay. And you know, again, if the Bears, I think the Bears are going to be addressing those skill positions early and often throughout this draft, but I still think it's probably like a year or two away from us, you know, definitively saying that the Bears have like a discernible core group of guys that you can point to, you know, outside of Jordan Howard that are really exciting from a fantasy aspect, you know, outside of
yeah fantasy. Meredith was looking all right, but his injury is pretty concerning, right? And we don't really know what he might be able to do, but it seems like Cohen and Howard can at least be the foundation with along with Trubisky, and I anticipate that kind of up tempo run heavy thing, like kind of a, you know, Baylor kind of approach, run a lot of plays and especially base it on the ground, at least until they get someone who you know, other than Adam Shaheen can catch it all.
Right.
So, but once they do that, it'll be interesting. And in the meantime, I think in fantasy, it's like the price tags on these guys might be so low that it's a good value, even if the product in real life terms isn't quite yet competitive.
Okay. I think that's a really good way of framing it. So we're going to move elsewhere in the division. Jim Caldwell gone from Detroit. Matt Patricia, obviously.
Whatever.
Famously, yeah. The defensive coordinator.
It's
for the
Jim
Lions.
Bob Cooter team.
Yeah.
Matt Patricia is, yeah, like the whole novelty is like, he looks like he's a mechanic, but he's actually a, you know,
brain genius.
I've never been hired rocket scientist instead. Like, oh, wow.
Amazing. Yeah. And wow.
And that defense was always good in New England too. So
right. It's not like we were
practical.
Talking about, you know, Cam Newton before Cam Newton kind of came back to being Cam Newton this year. Everyone was really worried about him. They go up to New England and just shred Patricia's defense.
They improved over the year, to be fair, but I think it's just kind of clear, like the novelty exceeds the merit.
Yes,
like, it's,
absolutely.
It's definitely one of those things.
That's a classic case of anyone leaving New England.
Yeah, it feels like kind of like a Mike Singletary kind of hire where they're like, did you hear about this thing he yelled at the guy? And it's like, oh, wait, the coaching part. We forgot to see if he could do that.
He wants winners.
So, yeah, I think Patricia's, you know, he might be a good like CEO type coach who runs an efficient operation, but I don't see much reason to think his defensive credentials specifically are going to fundamentally alter the team, especially when Terrell Austin was running that defense all along. And he's probably at least a pretty good defensive coordinator. And
as a Ravens fan, so Terrell Austin was the secondary coach during the Ravens Super
turnovers
Bowl
in Detroit, always making turnovers.
So yeah,
this might be a downgrade for their defense actually, but the good news is it's like Jim Bob Cooter seems to have enough suction in that town that Patricia just didn't have the political capital to replace him.
Right.
So that's good for Stafford, because Stafford had a career year last year, really turned a corner, especially in terms of his road game play. And you never generally want to see an offensive coordinator change after a franchise quarterback has a career year. So it should provide a stable foundation for the Detroit offense. And basically this team might not be fundamentally different from last year.
I could see that. I mean, and there really isn't a whole lot of reason to change. Alongside with what you said about Matthew Stafford there, I mean, Golden Tate's still obviously a hugely productive guy. Marvin Jones turned out to be, you know, from the NFL Next Gen Stats, one of the best like tight window receivers in the league. So, I mean, he's still got it, and he's got the good downfield ability as well.
Galladay,
you know, he's going to be stepping into year two. So
you would think Patricia might get his hands on the running game a bit. Because Jim Bob Cooter, for however much he might have done for Stafford, doesn't. To be fair, they didn't have any good personnel.
The run game is the redheaded stepchild of that offense.
Yeah, and part of it is like we don't really know how much of that is Jim Bob Cooter's fault yet, because the running backs there were terrible, and the front office couldn't have handled that much worse. But yeah, Patricia understandably might kind of be like, you know, you run your passing game fine, but we're going to do something different in the ground game this year, because last year definitely wasn't acceptable.
And that would be, you know, that they'd be a great team that to, you know, like we were saying, where they don't need a lot of wholesale changes in any one place, except maybe the run game. This is a very deep running back class. Maybe they could go attack that maybe like round two.
There's
round
no good three. Excuse to not get a totally like clear running back upgrade over what they have.
So yeah, we'll dive into that a little bit later. One of the more sort of publicly talked about coaching hires, one that slipped through the cracks, another Patriots disciple that decided to go back to the mothership. Josh McDaniels, you know, pulls back on his decision to go to Indianapolis.
He seems pretty cool.
Yeah, totally just awesome guy. And he was totally awesome before he kind of shirked his way back to New England from like the Denver job, right, from several years ago.
Yeah.
So obviously he'll long-standing career of being an awesome dude.
And all the actually clear positives in his history coincide with Tom Brady, Bill Belichick teams, so you know he's good on his own.
Oh, completely.
He's definitely worth all the hype that he's attracted over the past 12 years, but yeah, in any case, this Indianapolis one, they hired Frank Reich.
Did they get peer pressured into hiring Frank Reich?
I think he was probably, you know, one of the clearly best options, but I think it's a chump move by Reich to take that job, because it's like, why do you think McDaniels got out? Because he heard like, oh, you're only like 50-50 on Andrew Luck's shoulder, huh? Well, that's interesting. I have this thing.
And the rest of that roster.
Yeah, terrible, terrible team. Jim Irsay's got to be a nightmare to deal with as a person for so many reasons. And yeah, McDaniels heard pretty obviously like, oh, the Andrew Luck part that I assumed was going to be involved might not be involved. I'd rather do literally anything else in that case. And so yeah. He's like, yeah, I'll just not stay around here. Sorry about that.
So the ink's not dry. All right, let's just, yeah.
But yeah, Reich taking that job, it's like, this is a job that is set up to fail. Wait till next year, dude. But
yeah,
now he's going to get left with the bill, however it turns out there. And I'm not very optimistic because, again, I think Irsay is such a cancer to that whole organization that you would need a uniquely strong coach who can reverse the culture in spite of the owner. And I don't think Reich is that guy.
Yeah, probably not. And I don't know, for me, like my sort of just reaction to it was, you know, the Indianapolis just had this bad thing happen to him with the public, you know, mess that was McDaniels withdrawing. And then it just felt like it was sort of like a generated, like, well, Frank Reich was the offensive coordinator, and do y'all see how the Eagles won the Super Bowl last week?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's Peterson's offense, and perhaps Reich can do the same things similarly well, but
that was
wrong
what
to
I wanted to draw out of you.
To attribute any of that to Reich or John DeFilippo, who we'll talk about like both of those guys, they worked under Peterson. He might have taught them things. They might have been like-minded the whole time and have the same methods all along, but you can't say what happened in Philadelphia is necessarily because of them.
Yeah, and it felt like, you know, Reich became a hot name after the Super Bowl. Like, I don't think I remember hearing much.
He's been one of those, like, middle-temperature guys for, like, 8 years now.
He's like a quarterback coach for forever.
Yeah, it's like, basically,
you have to coach Philip Rivers.
Every time someone gets fired in Houston or Buffalo, people are like, oh, Frank Reich might be a good... He's a quarterback coach, and this is, like, 10 years ago that this stuff was happening. So
yeah.
I'm glad he finally got hired, and I'm glad it wasn't, you know, Buffalo or Houston.
Yeah, no, that
would have been so annoying.
That's a fair way to put it. Let's move on from Indianapolis. Let's go over to the Giants. Shurmur.
We've already seen Shurmur, but what's interesting here is it's like he's got a pretty stocked coordinator group, like Shula. You know, a bit of a failure in Carolina, but also probably overqualified to be an offensive coordinator on a team whose head coach is an offensive coordinator, Shurmur also being one. They got Betcher, I think, from Arizona, who was displaced by the Wilkes hire. Betcher had really good defenses there, so
okay.
The Giants seem to have a talented group of coaches. Whether the product turns out to be, you know, good enough, I have no idea, but it will be better than McAdoo.
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to get a whole lot worse than, you know, Mr. I'm the head of sanitation in this town.
Agent Decker is basically what he looks like.
That's a tremendous comp, actually.
Slightly more competent, actually. You would think it would be the other way around, but that's just not the kind of show Decker is. But, yeah, in any case... I'm not sure what there's probably not much to see changing with the Giants. Like if Shurmur's smart, he'll try to make Beckham and Shepard emulate what Thielen and Diggs did. And they have relatively similar skill sets. So I think it's a good approach that should work just fine. Beyond that, it's a tough division. So not much guaranteed for those guys, but yeah, Oakland with John Gruden, I guess might be the one that we have to listen to the most talk about this off season, given his, you know, chumminess with the media. And I don't know what
John
to think
Gruden.
About it at all, because like he was an offensive coach from the Mike Holmgren school. that had become obsolete when Gruden left the league 10 years ago. And like,
yeah, you could tell his offenses were getting stale in Tampa.
Yeah. And he was smart enough to say like, ooh, I don't know how to win anymore. I'm getting out. And like, what changed in those last 10 years? Was he watching from afar, taking notes, scheming the whole time? Or is he just like, oh, I'm bored with this commentator thing. I'm going to go coach like I did in 2006.
Well, he does talk to the rookie quarterbacks every year. So,
I mean, yeah, he knows about,
he's got his finger on the,
he's gamed with Paxton Lynch.
Run pass option here. You got a guy to the left, guy to the right. What do you do?
That's his accent.
I think that's what he sounds like.
Oh, wow. I guess I haven't heard him talk in a while because, if I'm watching a game, I'm definitely not listening to the commentators. But in any case, he hired Greg Olsen with an O as the offensive coordinator. And he was the offensive coordinator there like 3 years ago, I think. And it didn't go that well. But that was also the Terrell Pryor in the first year for Derek Carr. So don't know what to expect from the offense. Don't know if that guy, Greg Olsen, is just going to be taking orders from Gruden, or if Gruden's going to be humble in his return and be like, guys, I might not know how to do this. It's been a while. Don't know where that's going. I'm not that optimistic.
Is it
going
to be worse than Joe Gibbs Act 2?
I think it's going to be like the exact same thing. Like, it's
games just passed him by a little bit.
Yeah, I don't think it's going to be as good as Parcells 2 or 3, however many times he did that. It's searching for glory that has long since faded, probably. Mm-hmm. But in any case, I mean, their personnel was better, I think, than the Jack Del Rio results. I'm just not convinced that Gruden, particularly now that he's, you know, had his Margaritaville 10-year layoff here and stepping back into a Mark Davis operation, like, just might not be enough motivation and I don't know, attention to detail for it to be much different.
Okay. That's probably a fair way of looking at it. I enjoy John Gruden a lot, but again, like I don't know how this 10 years has treated his football brain. So
I think they're going to be like most teams, like sniff the wild card every once in a while,
that
just long enough
to do it.
Yeah.
You can pull that off over there.
I'm more interested in Vrabel with the Titans, only for the, not even the Vrabel part of it, but the LaFleur part of it, hiring him as offensive coordinator. He was technically the offensive coordinator for Sean McVay, or maybe it was the quarterback's coach. I can't remember. No, he was the offensive coordinator for McVay, in which case you're like, yes, McVay clearly is the one in charge of this operation. But if LaFleur just is good enough at copying him, he's still way better than most offensive coordinators in the NFL. And it's crucial to hire a guy like LaFleur with Marcus Mariota as the quarterback, because they wasted so much time and probably stunted his development a bit with Malarkey, who's stuck in 1997 or whatever. And now this is going in the opposite direction, and LaFleur, you know, the whole approach of guys like McVay and Peterson is not so much one of a philosophy so much as just pragmatism. Like, yeah, they're moneyballing the league. They looked at what works and what doesn't, and they're like, let's not do so many of those stupid things that don't work anymore post 1995. And so they're not committed to anything other than what the defense gives them. When you have Mariota, you know, you start to do things that Mike Malarkey decidedly avoided. And if that happens, it's like, I believe in Mariota fully. I think he's had some concerning moments, especially in the past year, but I think LaFleur, just by virtue of not only not being Malarkey, but not even being, you know, a Shermer type, like it's someone who's clearly invested in this new movement in the NFL, I think it can only turn out well for Mariota, at least in fantasy. Like, maybe they won't win playoff games, but I bet they're going to put up numbers.
And do you think that this is one of those where year one, it starts to pay dividends?
I think so, because Malarkey really is that bad. And like, they won't be as good in year one as year two, more than likely. But year one, I mean, they can't go down. Like, it can only get better. Sure. Mariota had a legitimately bad season, and that team was terrible. So it cannot get worse. It has to get better by, you know, the dead cat bounce, basically.
And it'll be interesting to see, and we're going to get into free agency here. We'll circle back to Tennessee on that momentarily. But, you know, like with Corey Davis missing a fair bit of the year, but showing some promise there towards the end, like kind of reflecting what we were expecting.
I'm not worried about him at all.
Exactly. So, like, you know, having that type of weapon for a full season, I think, is going to be huge for Mariota too. And again,
there's a lot of talent there.
Offense. Yeah,
I still believe in Taywan Taylor fully. Like, Jonnu Smith, Delanie Walker doesn't seem like he's done quite yet, but I like Jonnu Smith too.
Eric Decker probably.
Eric Decker's bad. Yeah, Rishard Matthews is good though. I think, like, this offense is just going to hit the ground running. I have no doubt. And that's, again, largely because it just, it would anyway.
Yeah, just a huge dead weight has been lifted.
Yeah, Mularkey just had to go. Just a plague on that team.
Support for this podcast comes from Wild Turkey Kentucky Straight Bourbon Whiskey. Let's tune in to their one-on-one with Jamal, a real bartender from Old Fourth Ward in Atlanta.
I really get into the backstory of whatever I'm pouring. Out of respect, there are literally years of experience behind these bottles. Wild Turkey, same recipe since 1942. If you want a true classic, this is what you want to order.
Wild Turkey. Wild Turkey Distilling Company, Lawrenceburg, Kentucky. Copyright 2020, Campari America, New York, New York. Never compromise, drink responsibly.
So with that, we're going to dive into the free agency.
Yeah, we talked about the coaches, so it's time to talk about all the players, both the ones who we already know but may go someplace different and the ones that you probably haven't heard of at all yet, or at least most of you.
Yes. So without further ado, I mean, the sort of early landscape of the offseason was, you know, hugely shifted with the Cousins, or not the, the Alex Smith trade over to Washington. Everyone's still scratching their heads about that, but one thing that's clear is Kirk Cousins will not be playing for the Redskins this coming season. So what's sort of like, if you're reading the tea leaves, you know, following along with the reports and everything, you think it's Denver? You think it's the Jets?
It seems like it would be one of either those two or the Vikings even. I hope he doesn't go to the Jets for, you know, obvious reasons. They're on a weird trajectory after firing actually John Morton, their offensive coordinator, and what I have to assume was retaliation for him screwing up their tanking plan, because their offense was way better than anyone expected, and then they replaced him with this guy who was like out of the league for 3 years and was only a quarterback's coach before that, including last year, and was otherwise only the coordinator for the 2010 Seahawks, who were terrible. I don't know why else they would do that. So I hope Kirk Cousins doesn't go there. I'd rather see him go to a decent team. I used to be a skeptic of Cousins, but after last year with, you know, first he had to depend on Chris Thompson so much, and then when Chris Thompson got hurt, the offense didn't really fall off. It's like he always found new ways to make it work. Even
he made like Ryan Grant like a real receiver and stuff.
Yeah, really tough conditions. He kept making it work somehow, even with the, you know, new rugs being pulled out from under him every single week. And so I'm pretty sold on him now. I thought last year was very impressive. And if he goes to the Vikings, like, they're probably my favorite in the conference, because I don't think Case Keenum is that good.
No,
I think he was much more than you could have asked of him last year, but I still think he's capped as like maybe the, you know, 22nd best quarterback in the league kind of thing. And his velocity limitations are profound. It really gets them into trouble sometimes and makes him dependent on those toss up plays. Like, it does work like once in a century, like that Diggs play, but generally it's not something that you can build on.
I mean, you look at that and you juxtapose that with the following week when the Vikings are in catch up mode pretty early on against the Eagles.
Exactly.
And all that the Vikings can run is dump offs.
The guys are getting their heads ripped off because of the pass rush. They know it's only going to take a second or two before someone gets the ball.
So I think that Case Keenum deserves better than what happened in that NFC Championship game. Like, what he was able to do with that offense for the full extent of the year, I think is probably better than what he showed in the NFC title game. But it also shows that there are some warts there, and it shows that he's definitely not going to be a guy that draws a long multi-year deal in the free agency. I think it would have been a mistake for that to happen anyway, but I think the NFC title game kind of cleared that up if there were any doubts.
Yeah, I don't. I mean, there's always so many teams that do stupid things.
Or at least
things.
Maybe to like the Vikings. Like, maybe
I don't
the
think they're
going
to want to. I mean, even Zimmer was week to week not saying like, I don't know, we might start Bradford. And I don't think he was saying that to be, you know, obtuse. I think he was saying just like, yeah, Case Keenum got us the win last week, and I know he can't make, you know, all these throws that we haven't needed to make in a few weeks but might need to this week. I don't want to commit to this because it might not be good enough. Mm-hmm. And I think he might, like, he'll get overpaid. I mean, he just kind of deserves it. Like, he deserves more pay than whatever he got. He, like, deserves back pay for last year's work. But he's not, I don't think, someone you can really build on. And I agree that he won't get a ton of attention and a ton of money. Like, I'm expecting it to be like one of those fake money deals where it's like, it looks big, but they basically are in a position to cut them after
like
1 year.
Like the Dalton one or something.
Yes. I don't know.
Dalton White.
Just something where it's like the team can clearly cut them after 1 year if they feel like it.
Okay. So let's stick in Minnesota then for a minute. So is this a situation where all three are gone?
I really don't know, because it's like, Teddy Bridgewater is, I think, the most interesting, the most originally talented of the group. That's like some historical revisionism, given that Sam Bradford was a first overall pick in his day, but I'm taking into account his scar tissue, I guess, when I say that. But then again, Bridgewater's knee injury was uniquely bad in some way, and I don't know enough about it to put values on it.
We saw what a knee dislocation looks like with the Zach Miller thing. I don't know if it looked anything like Bridgewater's, but that's pretty
right. There was danger as far as like the vascular, like the blood flow in the leg as a result of the injury, I think. And that's pretty, it sounds like they got it fixed faster than the Miller one, but it was still a similar danger. So yeah, it's like, I don't know how much the talent with either Bradford or Bridgewater even applies with their respective health limitations. And then Keenum, you can easily imagine getting priced out of their range. So yeah, I think you could see all three gone, but I'm guessing at least one stays, and probably Bridgewater, if only because it's like, he's probably really cheap since no one wants to pay him like a starting quarterback, and he has some roots there by now at least. And
true,
they've kind of stuck by him as much as they've replaced him. Like, they didn't just, you know, kick him out right away. So I think he could stick around, but they also need to, I think, go after Cousins, because the Keenum thing isn't good enough. Everything else was at peak performance in terms of the defense, the receivers, even the running game overachieved, especially given Cook's absence.
Exactly.
So they need Cousins, and I think if he's there, he'd be awesome, like point blank. Like, I think he's really good. And unlike the Jets, unlike the Broncos, the Vikings aren't in draft range to get someone through that. So it's like, I feel like they gotta go at Cousins. Who don't know if they'll get him, but I think it would work out pretty well.
Yeah, that's an interesting one. I think that one probably hasn't been talked enough about. It seems like anytime that I look into it a little bit more, it seems like the Broncos. But I feel like the Broncos, if I'm them, and let's say that Cousins does end up in Minnesota, what do they do at five? Because there's presumably going to be at the very worst, like the third best quarterback available by that point.
Yeah. If Cousins goes to Minnesota, that's the worst case scenario for guys. I think Sam Darnold will be okay either way, but like Josh Allen, I'm still skeptical that he ever was a top 10 consideration. But if Cousins signs with Minnesota, that would be the best case for those guys. If he signs with Denver, it's the worst, because
that takes away a top 10 pick, right?
Yeah,
there.
People were talking about, you know, Cleveland should trade for Alex Smith, and then they can still draft, you know, a guy at first or third or whatever. And by the time Smith is on the way down, they can go to the rookie. Well, if you sign Cousins, he's still going to be good by the time the rookie is ready. So you can't really justify doubling up at quarterback in that case. So if he goes to the Broncos, that's really bad news for someone like Josh Allen, maybe even Lamar Jackson. Who knows? But in any case, it's like, we're expecting Josh Rosen and Sam Darnold to be the first two picked, I think. And I personally would take Lamar Jackson and Baker Mayfield over them both, but I certainly don't expect the NFL to think similarly.
Yeah. And let's get more into that. I mean, I think that just for me, Rosen right now, he might not have the absolute highest ceiling of these guys, but I think right away, like, he can be like a borderline Pro Bowl type of player, like right off the bat. Like, he has that sort of touch. I think he gets mischaracterized as someone that's not tough, but like, he stands in there, he makes the throws, he can use the middle of the field. He's a bit risk taker, you know, gunslinger with some of his throws over the middle, but you know, he's a guy that you know, churned out a lot of production from receivers that, you know, there's probably only going to be one that he played with that ends up being anything at the NFL level.
Yeah, I think it's safe to say Rosen is the consensus top quarterback and the one that I would guess is picked first.
Yeah.
I think that Baker Mayfield is the most naturally talented passer in the class. I would guess most people would give Rosen that title, and then the ones who don't might still rationalize Rosen as the better prospect because he's not 6 feet flat. He's 6'4", 220, whereas Mayfield's probably going to be like 6'2", 10 his whole career.
Yep.
I don't really care about that stuff, but the NFL certainly will. So yeah, I think Rosen basically qualifies as the best natural passer among prototype sort of options in the class. And Darnold has the tools to maybe get to the same sum, but he's more raw, needs more refining to do it, and is probably relies more on unconventional means than Rosen, which understandably makes coaches nervous. You don't want to bet on something that might basically be an aberration. So when Darnold does his wacky stuff to make big plays,
he makes it happen. But like you said, like
you might prefer the guy who gets the boring slant on the same play instead.
Yeah, so. Seriously. And the thing about Darnold really is that, you know, if we were talking this time last year and then looking at the quarterback class from last year, we probably would be building an argument that the Darnold was the best of anyone that would have been.
Yeah, I think he would have been. I think he would have. There would have been a good chance he would have been the first overall pick if it weren't for the NFL's labor rules.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, this year he comes back and it's just, there's a lot of warts to his game. And I think one of the things that's going to be one of the huge storylines is you're going to be annoyed by it. If you're listening to this podcast now, you're going to be extremely annoyed by this narrative by the time the end of the month rolls around with like, oh, he fumbled, you know, 10 times last year. We're going to need to see the hand size. Like that's going to become a thing. That's going to factor into cold weather teams and whether they consider him a little bit.
Yeah. And that's fair. I have no idea what his hands are supposed to measure as. And I honestly haven't gotten far enough into quarterback tape, at least with Darnold, to really get a suspicion there, but
he's got a wonky delivery too. I will say,
yeah, he has that. I'm not so worried about it. I understand the anxiety about it, but it's like
it's not left witch.
It doesn't look any weirder than like Philip Rivers has ever did, mm-hmm. And he's got like the arm velocity, like it's, and he does. It's even
people killed him for that Ohio State game, but if you watch that, like he was dropping some serious dimes down the sideline, like towards the end of that game on guys like Denzel Ward and stuff. So I mean, like I think people kind of can underestimate his arm strength a little bit. I think he's got
pretty much a cannon, doesn't he? Like his arm always looked really impressive when I watched.
It's good. I think it's better than some people are
saying. It's not like his weird throwing motion is to generate this artificial velocity. It's like the velocity is there naturally. He just doesn't look quite the same as other people when he throws it. And it's not a timing issue. It's not like a huge windup. Like it's not even a windup like Kaepernick's, let alone one like Tebow or something like that. So I'm not personally frightened by that, but I guess its issues could come in with like he has a problematic footwork aspect that if they change might not be super compatible with how he plants for throwing, something like that. Yeah, I guess
people
that'll
tag him for throwing off his back foot.
Maybe that'll come up in the pre-draft evaluation process. But I would guess after Rosen that Darnold's combination of size and athleticism and arm strength and, like winning ability basically. And it's also worth remembering like, A, he's still pretty young, and B, he declined this year, which coincided with Juju Smith-Schuster leaving the offense. So it's easy enough to imagine like if Smith-Schuster at 20 years old had been playing for USC this year instead of the NFL, that Darnold's numbers wouldn't have even looked different.
Yeah. I mean, we could have seen a situation not completely unlike D.D. Westbrook and Baker Mayfield from last year, like both being like top five Heisman considerations.
Yeah. And I love Mayfield, by the way, and I think he'll be like a top 10 pick, certainly no worse than top 15. But yeah, he had an amazing last 2 years, and I was initially skeptical of him, but I'm in on him. And Lamar Jackson, written a lot about him on the site lately, and I think he's not going to be appreciated by most coaches, but if the ones that do see how he can work have any brains, they're going to want to get him on their team, because the stuff about him playing wide receiver is just garbage, and everyone who said it is going to be embarrassed to the point that they'll deny having ever said it. Not a year or two from now, more like in a couple months. Like they're going to have all these people renouncing their stupid Lamar Jackson takes, and it's not even going to take long, because it is just preposterous what these people have been saying about him. Like he's not as accurate as these other guys. He can't fit in an I formation like North Turner offense, but he can work for guys like McVay and Peterson, and they're the ones who are going to own the league. So
there you go. I mean, it's as simple as that. I mean, like the stuff that he can do when he's good is unlike anything that anyone else can do. I mean, there's a cut up last night of his game against North Carolina from this year. Standing at his own 20, free blitzer comes in, shakes the blitzer in a way that no one else in the NFL probably could, except maybe like a Russell Wilson or something. And then launches one with, you know, if you want to get into throwing and pure passing stuff, like Jackson might have the best arm in this class, and like it, he does it with a flick of the wrist, but just like Michael Vick.
He has a super low effort delivery, but unprecedented distance and velocity.
He doesn't need to like step, which, you know, like it might not be like the...
It looks like he's laying up the ball when he throws it, and it just chucks out like a cannonball.
Yeah, he hit like Jalen Smith on the play I'm talking about, you know, like probably 50, 55 yards, maybe even 60 yards in the air with, you know, with running room, hit him in stride, and then Smith just kind of saunters in for the touchdown there.
Basically, all of Lamar Jackson's game tape is just filled with stupid plays. I honestly think like the degree to which he has just made a mockery out of everything in college football is part of why people are just like dismissing him. They're just desensitized to the absurdity of his play that they're, I guess it's kind of understandable.
Are they attaching like the video game numbers skepticism that they would to like a, you know, like a Graham Harrell or Colt?
I don't think it's that. I think
different games.
It's a couple things. It's like they see how successful he is as a runner, the magnitude of it, and they say like, oh, he's run dependent. You're like, no, he's still as pass dependent as your other quarterback. He just takes more of a running burden than them. He's not doing Pat White things like throwing 1,800 yards a year, running for 1,800 yards. He's running for, you know, 1,600 yards a year and throwing for 3,700.
Yep.
It's like he's doing both. He's not dependent. You can say he's prolific as a runner. You cannot say he's dependent. It's stupid. You can't say it. So yeah, he's just doing all these things that look borderline impossible. And I guess it's like some people's responses to say, well, that's because it is impossible. And I'm thinking, no, it's probably not.
Right. So I guess with that, what's like your ideal landing spot for him? And would it be a place where he's thrust into starting right away? And I know that's a loaded question because starting right away,
even Deshaun Watson didn't do it. And it's like, in hindsight, he clearly deserved it.
Yeah. I mean, that was one that you and I both saw through that pretty quickly, that Watson of the picks from the first round last year, that he had the clearest path out of any of them.
Yeah. I didn't expect him to be that good, to be fair. No,
that was absurd.
Yeah. But I do think Lamar Jackson presents the same dangers to the NFL. It's like he kills you repeatedly deep, because if you don't put your safeties up to stop, give contain help, first of all, like you're not going to contain him with your defensive line. You need at least one spy. Is it going to be your linebacker? Is it going to be your safeties? If it's the linebacker, he's probably just going to outrun him. If it's your safeties, you're not helping your deep threats where Lamar can get, you know, 60 yards downfield in 2 seconds if he feels like it. So I feel like he's just going to kill people deep over and over. And he might have some cold stretches as a passer, because I don't think he's that good at short and intermediate routes.
No.
But the way you can use his athleticism, especially off of play action, to stress the defense in different directions, you can spread them thin, and then he just tears through them every time. So I really like his chances, as long as he doesn't have an idiot coach. And as far as that goes, admittedly, it is a bit bleak finding a landing spot that seems favorable for him, because it's like, I would want him to play for teams that basically already have quarterbacks. I want him to play for the Rams and the Eagles and even someone like Belichick or something like that. But yeah, we'll see what his combine measurements are. I wouldn't be shocked if he doesn't have, if he has, you know, like not huge hands, and that might raise valid weather concerns. But maybe a good spot would be 15, Arizona. But I can also imagine them taking Baker Mayfield over him, and I wouldn't even really be able to blame them for it. But yeah, 15 might work with Arizona. Having the dome there would be nice for him, bring out his speed and downfield passing that much more. But after that, it's like, I think Baltimore makes sense if they don't worry about the weather aspect. The Chargers at 17, somebody like that. And I do think that it could be a Dak Prescott thing too, where not that is any fault to the fourth round, but like he just ends up somewhere eventually, and the team gets to, or Russell Wilson would be the better comparison actually. Like, they get to training camp and they just realize right away, like, oh, he's our best player. He's the best player in our entire team. And then they like just at that point kick out some presumed stopgap guy who they're like, yeah, never mind, we don't need you.
So this hasn't even happened yet, but Case Keenum, you're getting benched for Lamar Jackson.
Yeah, exactly. Something like that. Maybe even Joe Flacco, John.
Oh, that would be amazing.
So probably not. But that's what I basically see happening there. And after those guys, as far as the rookie quarterbacks go, I should mention, first of all, John and I did a three-round dynasty rookie mock draft for a 12-team league. So there was 36 picks, and we both did three honorable mentions, I believe, where we talked about their dynasty value going forward and how we would probably pick in that scenario that we did at the time, which was a day before the Senior Bowl. I also put up my own dynasty rankings in the football section that goes pretty deep, and we talk about these things in our respective analyses for these entries. entries that we've listed in these two articles if you want to read up more about the rookies. But yeah, at quarterback, otherwise, I don't have any interest in Josh Allen, and Mason Rudolph might do something, but he's probably not going to be more than like a Mark Bolger kind of quarterback or something like that.
Yeah, I think we could see...
I'm more interested in Lauletta than Allen. And I don't even know anything about Lauletta.
he was a boss at the Senior Bowl. Right. So, I mean, he's definitely vaulted himself into draftable consideration.
He could do that point. John Beck thing where like he goes and, you know, 36th overall, and everyone wonders like, how did that happen?
It's just like after the. All right, so I think you and I are decidedly that like there are four like surefire like first round and also good quality starters in this draft. You know, Josh Allen, the opinions again will vacillate, but. Like after them, people try to make like Mike White from Western Kentucky a thing, a Kirk Benkert from Virginia.
Maybe I would say Benkert maybe more than White, but White was like run out of South Florida after being terrible there, and he barely got a starting. He didn't actually have a starting role last year. It was like they were doing a rotation with Tyler Ferguson and somebody else, and that's bad when you can't win a starting job at Western Kentucky. Basically,
yeah, it wasn't good. And you know, to say that Benkert is better isn't necessarily to say that Benkert is good, because he certainly has his warts too, and that they kind of showed.
He got
up
run out of Eastern Carolina.
Yeah, which is incredible, actually.
Much more interesting position in the draft is the running backs.
There we go.
Who coincide with a probably not so interesting group of free agents, although there's a couple interesting guys. I mean, I'm assuming Le'Veon Bell's just not going to be among them, technically, as he might be at the moment. So you go straight to Carlos Hyde, basically, as the most interesting free agent, and it seems like the 49ers don't want him. Like, maybe they changed their mind in the last year, but before the season, they were like, we gotta get rid of this guy. Let's draft Joe Williams, anybody, just get rid of Carlos Hyde.
See, where they're drafting right now? I mean, this could change. They could be smart and trade back again, you know, come April, but where they're drafting right now, you know, the 9-10 range, do they go for a running back right there and let Hyde walk?
I don't think so. I mean, it's running back. You generally don't want to
let Hyde walk at that point.
Yeah, you generally don't want to spend that kind of stuff, in my opinion, on a running back these days, unless it's Saquon. And Saquon could fall that far, I guess. It wouldn't be that shocking. I mean, Saquon falling to where do they pick? I'm trying to pull this up here. It's going to be 9 or 10, I guess. So yeah, Saquon could fall there. I mean, Saquon falling to 9 is much less weird than Marshawn Lattimore falling to 9. So who knows? But yeah, I would think they just want someone who can catch passes pretty well, because Hyde took a lot of targets last year and wasn't particularly efficient with any of them. I think McNichols could pick that up next year and basically kick Breida out of the picture. But they do want someone who can give some power, and be it someone like Royce in, you know, the second, third round, or Barkley at 9 or 10. I guess that would work, but I would expect probably some dumber team basically to take Barkley in the top 8, something like that.
I think the sort of mainstream consensus right now is Barkley ends up being one of Cleveland's first two picks.
I guess, I mean, that I do think their new guard is very stupid, and I think that would be a stupid thing to do, as much as I think Barkley is a totally awesome player. So yeah, Josh Allen at 1, Barkley at 4. Let's go.
Oh my gosh, that'd be something.
It won't happen. The Allen thing is not happening. I keep trying to laugh about it because it's so stupid, but it's not happening. I hope it does, but it won't.
Well, I mean, yeah, like you said, Allen.
If the Browns hire Ben McAdoo as offensive coordinator, who do they? Oh no, they already got Haley. It can't work. Dang it. If it had happened, then McAdoo would have been like pounding the table for Allen, and it would have been amazing.
No question. That would be something.
But yeah, in any case, it's like Barkley's the guy. He's so good as a prospect that we might be talking about him as like an early second round pick in 12 team leagues for NFL. If he goes to a place where they commit to him as the workhorse,
like I can see, like, I feel like no matter where he lands, I would be more comfortable taking Barkley this year than I was taking Fournette last year at where he was going ADP-wise.
Yeah, he's definitely the better player than Fournette, I think. And it's actually very timely and useful that Todd Gurley had the season he had, because this is going to become an obnoxious cliche probably, but Barkley really is a lot like him in the sense that they're both, you know, 230-pound guys who we don't know what Gurley would have run in the 40, but I'm guessing in the 4.4s, and Barkley might be in the 4.3s. Like, he actually seems to have an identical skill set to gurley, but might be even more athletic. And he might not have the greatest vision out of the backfield, but he's just so uniquely lethal in open space, and he's so good at getting to the open space. Like, and he's so good as a pass catcher too, which all of that feeds into the other, just a lot of explosiveness. So there's a lot of big plays that are going to happen with him.
Yeah. He's really just kind of an unbelievable guy to watch. And he's someone that, you know, you and I, 2015, rainy Saturday, Penn State versus Buffalo in September. And Penn State had no running backs to speak of that anyone knew of to that point. They let Barkley in garbage time and he just runs all over Buffalo. It's like, wait a second. Like, they might actually have the running back of the future, and turned out, you know, we're brain geniuses.
Yeah, you were on him first. I was like, Akeel Lynch, this is the year.
Bill Belton's gone.
Yeah, so Bill Belton too. Yes, in any case, we got not many other names among the free agents. It's like Jerick McKinnon. He's fast. He can catch. He can't do anything else.
He can't be the I saw a quote from him, kind of seeking out to be the starter wherever he lands next. It's just,
there's no,
like,
demand.
I don't see that happening.
There's no demand. There's no openings. He'd need like a 40 team league to get a starting job, I think. And he's good at what he does, but he is quite limited. He has no leg drive at all. Like, he can catch, he can run, he's quick.
You think like Seattle would go get him, or Oakland?
I think someone will sign him, and Seattle would make sense because he's a workout warrior and they do like the guys with great workout metrics. But yeah, he's going to be basically a 30% snap guy, I think. Similarly, I feel about Deion Lewis and Rex Burkhead. Like, they had good years for the Patriots, and I thought we already did this with Deion Lewis, where everybody's like, oh, he's really going to be a star in this Belichick offense. And I know he got hurt the other time, but there's been a plenty of time in between those events where he hasn't done much, and not for a great deal of competition on the depth chart ahead of him. So I think he is clearly just uniquely well suited to the New England offense.
He's at his best up in Foxborough.
Like, yeah, he's not as
useful somewhere else. He's not going to be as
not good. As half as useful as for anybody else. But I think that for that reason, both he and Burkhead will be back in New England, because there's no demand for the scraps of that offense. I mean, some stupid team might fall for it, but I don't know. I'm not expecting a whole lot for them, or Isaiah Crowell, or Damian Williams, and yet those are like the biggest names on this list that we got.
Yeah, it really thins out, and it's pretty, you know, scant to begin with. Like we said, with Hyde being like kind of the clear cut one that is going to be going to eventually hit
right.
Free agency.
And it's the worst timing for those free agent running backs too, because the class is so good. Besides Barkley, like Nick Chubb, before he tore up his knee 3 years ago, it was like we were thinking, like, this guy is the next huge deal running back, and Barkley came along and took that distinction. But I don't think it's by much, and I'm not even really willing to concede that he's definitely better than Chubb, who has he wasn't himself his first year back, still quite good, still like a fourth round pick his first year back. Came back this year, and now he's looking like a first round pick, clearly made a lot of progress. And we've got some people doing GPS readings on him. I can't remember what the setting was, but basically it looks like he might run a 40-yard dash below the 4.50 mark. If he runs a 4.45 at like 5.9.5, 225, I don't understand how he falls out of the first round, and it seems like it's something he could do. And then there's the whole matter of, is his kind of backup Sony Michel better than him despite all that? And I'm agnostic on that. I'm generally team Chubb, but it's like, I feel like with those two, Darius Geis, we're talking about guys who are in such a talented category of running ability that it's like, they're all going to be really good.
Yeah, it's just a matter of preference for what your offense is or whatever, because yeah, all three of those guys can definitely play. Geis kind of like runs a little bit wild in my opinion, and
yeah,
and sometimes like he just runs himself into trouble a fair bit. And I know Barkley, like the people that and it happens with pretty much any prospect, especially one that is sort of ironclad, like, okay, Barkley comes into the year as number one. We get a little bit tired of it around this time, so we start trying to poke some holes a little bit. And like Barkley, I think that you showed me some cut-ups of him where he just doesn't take what the defense is giving him sometimes, and he tries to do too much. Geis is also really, really guilty of that a lot of the time. Whereas, I don't know if it's just by virtue of being seniors, but Michelle and Chubb seem to be a little more patient and try to like see the hole and just go ahead and hit it. There's a lot less like dancing tomfoolery going on.
Yeah, Chubb especially, that was one thing that was unique about him, and one thing that is in his favor that Barkley doesn't have in his, is that Chubb was always just, he could close his eyes or run blindfolded between the tackles. Like, he just can do it, and he probably doesn't have to think about it. He probably couldn't tell you after he does it how he did it. It's just easy for him. Yeah, Geis, it's like he kind of gets away from the defense by getting the defense to chase him, and then he runs away from it rather than kind of like just cutting through it. But yeah, he's really great at it. There might be some kind of like David Wilson risk, and you know, the sense that he's like a just super athletic, super hard to catch guy who, yeah, might not give you production quite proportionate to his, you know, raw talent, but he was super productive those first 2 years at LSU.
Yeah, and then last year, single game record at LSU, which is a hard school to do that at.
Yeah. And last year he was playing nicked up at a few points when he dropped down to, you know, 5 yards a carry or whatever, like before he was at like almost eight.
Yeah. And so, yeah, his freshman year, I think he had like 81 carries and he was averaging like almost nine a carry. It's ridiculous.
But yeah, he might not do a whole lot as a pass catcher. Like Darrell Williams took a lot of that pass catching work in that backfield and did more on a per target basis than Geis did. So like maybe Geis's projection in the NFL is more like one of those guys who runs for tons of yardage but doesn't catch a whole lot, someone like D'Angelo Williams. But if he is limited to that, I would say Geis is still going to be like 110% of the pure runner. Like instead of having a, you know, 1400 yards, he's going to have 1600 yards in that year basically.
If their carries were equal or something.
Yeah, and he's going to have a lot of big plays as a runner. If he gets some volume with carries, like he's going to have some huge games.
Right, because he is like we were saying, just kind of a freak show athletically. So it'll be interesting to see kind of how it all shakes out. I think the combine will kind of settle some of those scores between that second tier. I think we both assume that Barkley's first running back off the board. So I think those next three guys, is there like a fourth one that you think also kind of floats in with them? I think it's,
well, you
like,
pointed out Ronald Jones, and I think he actually could be the second running back selected.
He's picking up a lot of steam right now.
Yeah. I think it's one of those things where he could be the second running back selected in the real draft, but I would still kind of put him at a worse fantasy projection than workhorse candidates like Chubb and Michelle and Geis. I think you could even argue that Rashad Penny and Royce Freeman should be ahead of him for fantasy, even though they probably are going to go like a round or two later than him. But Jones, it's just one of those things where it's like the guy is about 6'200". We know he's extremely fast. He can kill defenses and single plays by just, outrunning the angle basically. And the question is, how much can he hold up with at 200 pounds? Because if he gains weight, he's negating some of that speed that makes him so unique in the first place. So it's like, is this role where he's probably limited to about 12 carries per game, is it worth spending the first round pick to you? And I think for some team, it will be. It's just might be one of those things where it's like he's a player more feared than productive, I guess.
Okay.
In a volume sense. I think he'll be super explosive and efficient.
That's an interesting way of putting it. And, you know, I'm trying to think of what's interesting about him is like, USC was kind of dumb with his usage the first 2 years, but I think it kind of plays to his favor a little bit. But at the same time, we don't fully know what like serious workhorse numbers look like for him, or like what it really turns out to be. Because I mean, USC, they gave him the most carries this year, obviously, but before that, was it like Trey Madden?
Yeah, they were rotating with guys like him and Justin Davis. Yeah, I want to say,
yeah, guys that just weren't as good.
Even but like Jones, Ty Isaac or something.
Gosh, yeah. So Jones was clearly the best running back there, and like this was finally the year for him to show it out. And
T. Martin was running a very traditional offense there, like a lot of not spread out basically. And yeah, I think if Jones were used properly, it'd be more like I guess I don't know what the better offense would be, but just something that kind of gets him in space more often, not so much running between the tackles, more getting him in screen opportunities, things like that.
Maybe like Oklahoma offense, right?
They use like, honestly, it's like almost anything nowadays. Yeah. Like T. Martin's back in 2002 or something like that. But in any case, I think Jones might do something like run a 4-3 flat and get into the first round that way. But I mean, there's so many other good running backs too, like Rashad Penny and Royce Freeman, like I mentioned, could be workhorse guys more than Jones because they're over 220. Royce could be pushing like 240, and it's all easy good weight. Yes. Like, and I think he's been that build since he was like 17. So yeah. It's like he's, I think, a better athlete than people are ready for. Like, he showed up as a true freshman and almost immediately kicked out Byron Marshall and Thomas Tyner from the offense. And like, Marshall was coming off like a 1200 yard year. Tyner was like a borderline 5-star recruit.
Yep, the first from the state of Oregon, I think.
Yeah. And then Freeman came in and they just immediately built the offense around him. And it's like, maybe he's not going to run like a 4.45 or something. Like, he almost certainly won't. But even if he only runs like a 4.6 or something like that in the 40, Freeman is a guy who has been so good and was so good so early that it's hard to explain his success if he doesn't have some kind of unique athleticism. Like, maybe he's an elite athlete in the way that Le'Veon Bell is, even if he's not, going to be out running defenses or something like that. And Royce caught the ball well. So I think he's really, really good and probably overlooked, which it's understandable because there's only so many running backs you can keep track of in this class. And Penny falls victim to the same thing. Like, he was insane at San Diego State, much better than Donnell Pumphrey. He finished his career with 7.5 yards a carry, 5 carries. Kick returns for touchdowns, just over incredibly explosive production for a guy who's over 220 pounds. So it's, you watch him on film and it's kind of like Royce, like, he doesn't look that fast, but how does he keep doing this if he's not something, you know, like if he's not quicker than we think, if he's not more explosive or faster than he just looks on tape, like, how is any of this happening? It doesn't make any sense. And he lit up the Senior Bowl too. So it wasn't just like a competition thing. He ran all over Stanford, et cetera, et cetera. So I believe in Rashad Penny. Totally. I like him and Royce quite a lot as dynasty picks, because I think they could have like 3 down skill sets. And otherwise, I guess we're mostly looking at guys like Josh Adams and like the 4th round range, and Nyheim Hines. I'm probably saying his name wrong. He could be like the other Ronald Jones in the class, because he's a track guy who might run in the 4.3s, and he can catch. He has more of a pass catching history than Jones, actually.
Yes, he does. So there is, I mean, like, to the extent where Nyheim Hines, like, I didn't know for sure, and UNC or NC State wasn't coming out and saying it like declaratively that Hines was going to stick as their number one running back, because, you know, they had to replace Matt Days, and it wasn't sure if it was going to be Reggie Gillespie or if it was going to be Hines. They ended up both getting well over 100 carries. Hines, really impressive though, this year. He was always a guy to me that he was probably the best recruit that an NC State can possibly pull in. And over the first couple of years, you see him and you see the talent occasionally, but you see so many boneheaded like mistakes that he was making.
I was worried it was another like Taquan Mizzell for a moment there, but it turns out like he has the wheels though.
Yeah,
like,
Mizzell really was slow. I see him being in that same range as Jones. I still think Jones would be my odds-on favorite to be the fastest 40 among the running backs, probably.
Could be. Yeah, I don't know. But, yeah, it seems like they'll both be in the 4.3s, something like that.
I guess circling back, just Hines, like, he's fine. He's a little bit smaller than Jones. I think he's probably closer to, like, a 5'9", 200 pounds or something. So I guess that technically makes him a little bit more like dense, like BMI wise. But there's stuff to like about Hines, but he is sort of Ronald Jones light.
Jones is the better player. I don't think there's any question about that, but yeah, I'm going to take the liberty of skipping receivers going to tight ends because of, incidentally, another running back, perhaps. Jalen Samuels, we don't know where he's going to play. It's either going to be running back or tight end. I thought he was
educate the people, please.
Yeah, I thought he was going to be more like an NFL novelty who was a more interesting college player than a productive pro one, but he apparently lit up the Senior Bowl, and it's like he's going to be at risk of running a 4.7 or something like that at about 225 pounds, but he must be quick or something. He might have that kind of Royce Freeman athleticism again, because it's like when he runs routes, he keeps getting open against these linebackers and even apparently some safeties. So he played tight end and running back at North Carolina State, and slot receiver, and probably regular receiver too. He catches the ball, he keeps getting open, he seems to run well after the catch. We don't really know how any of it happens, and we also don't even know what position he plays. But in fantasy and dynasty leagues, you might want to try to sneak him onto your team if he has a tight end classification, because he might basically be a tight end in the NFL who gets carries.
Yeah, which is,
and that's never happened. Yeah, so it's just, he might be like Larry Centers with tight end eligibility, which would be crazy.
That's nuts. I love that.
Larry Centers had like 90 catches a couple of years back in the 90s. For, I don't know, Buffalo and Arizona or something like that.
Yeah.
But yeah,
he'll be working out as a tight end at the combine after doing running back stuff.
Yeah, they listed him as a running back at the Senior Bowl. Now he's listed as a tight end. Who knows how this turns out? But the other tight ends are boring. It's like there's Mark Andrews, there's Dallas Goedert from South Dakota State. Those two guys might be in the first round conversation. After them, there's not really much. And among the tight end free agents, it's like Jimmy Graham, Austin Safarian Jenkins, Cameron Brate. They're all okay, I guess. I'm more interested in Trey Burton from Philadelphia, who can really run after the catch. Could be exactly what Jordan Reed has been, and he has basically no health concerns.
Yeah.
By heavy contrast, and Philadelphia showed him off a little bit this year. I bet he gets them a nice compensatory pick. But to close things off with the wide receivers, now there's more to work with the free agents there. Sammy Watkins, who it sounds like the Rams are going to try to bring him back, because that would make sense. I don't know how that result of last year happens without the simple explanation that he got in, you know, late in training camp and they couldn't put together the plan for it. He's awesome. He's a great talent. I'm still fully convinced of that. Allen Robinson might have more defenders these days, even with that ACL. I figure he'll be a hot consideration for the 49ers if they're going to spend some wide receiver money. Otherwise, you would think the Jaguars are going to really try to keep him, though, because I don't know why they wouldn't. Jarvis Landry is another big name amongst casual media, but anybody
getting the Baltimore treat. A lot of people are linking.
Oh, man, that would be bad.
I don't know about
because he's not that good, is the thing. Like, he's good, but he's not going to be nearly as useful as this price tag. And his production in Miami, I'm sorry, it's just been inflated by a yieldless scheme.
You never see yards per catch that low for a receiver.
Yeah, like, that's a receiver who you get those catches and targets that Landry does if an offense is not scoring points. Like, there's no other way it happens.
That's a perfect fit.
There's not enough targets to go to that volume if they're scoring points ever. So, but he's a good slot receiver. It's just that he's a good slot receiver, and there are a lot of those. They're easy. It's a low bar to be a useful slot receiver in the NFL. That's why you don't put your best athletes at the slot. You put them outside where their skills might actually have some scarcity. Slot receivers aren't scarce. So I don't like Landry. I think he's going to tank whatever offense signs him, and I think it'll be a bad team that does sign him. Much rather would have Dante Moncrief for Terrell Pryor.
Yeah, there's some stuff. There's, you know, some stuff left in the tank for those guys, and there's way more athleticism than like a Landry too.
Yeah, Moncrief is pretty interesting for dynasty bylow because
24?
Yeah, he's 24, and it's one of those obvious cases, I think, where everyone expected the final product 2 years too soon. He's going to be really cheap now, and you know, can't get worse than last year. Also, I think Albert Wilson, Marquise Lee, kind of interesting. I'm not a huge fan of Paul Richardson or somebody like that.
I've seen some linkage of Albert Wilson maybe following the Nagy over to Chicago.
Oh, that would be good. That would make sense. Yeah, I didn't realize how good his workout numbers were. I only knew him as the Georgia State guy for before Penny Hart was the Georgia State guy. And he's been pretty productive on a per target basis, and he was certainly good in college. So that'll be interesting to watch. He'd be a good sleeper in an up-tempo offense.
And then another guy, like you mentioned, I thought Marquise Lee, I was a huge doubter of his coming into this year. I thought he played a lot better than I was expecting. I don't have like super high expectations of him, but I think he could be like a totally functional wide receiver too. I thought he was like going to be a bust, basically.
Yeah, he's okay. That's about it. So I think he'll probably be overpaid wherever he is, but he's all right. Whatever.
Okay. All right.
He's no Calvin Ridley or James Washington, but he might be okay nonetheless. Those two. I would say Christian Kirk from A&M is also in the race to be the first receiver picked, but it's all coming down to the combine, basically. If Ridley doesn't put that like sub or low 4.4 at least, ideally sub 4.4 kind of speed. If Washington runs like a 4.55 or something like that, if both of those things go poorly for those two, then I do think Kirk could leapfrog them because I don't think he's going to hurt himself here. Like, he's been a possession receiver in college doing 12.2 yards per catch, but then you look at his punt return stats and it's like, okay, he's outrunning somebody at least.
Yes. You also look at the tape and it's crazy like how shifty he can be in the open field and his vision. Like, he's just a really smart football player, and as far as his hands go, they're extremely reliable. So yeah, I think it, like you said, if the bottom drops out as far as those workout numbers go for Ridley or Washington, which one, if you had to guess, like flip a coin, or not flip a coin, but just who would you be less surprised by messing up at the combine, a Ridley or a Washington?
I'd be less surprised by Washington, I think, because he's been super explosive production-wise, but also playing in the Big 12, playing in that Oklahoma State offense, he's got a much bigger field to work with. It's like comparing a CFL receiver to an NFL one when you talk about Washington versus Calvin Ridley and in terms of their context that they had to play within. So it wouldn't be shocking if Washington was super explosive in college, even if he, like, we remember Leonte Carew. He didn't have
Leonte Carew.
Yeah, I still think he's probably good, but it's like, I think that's the worst case scenario for like Washington's eventual outcome. And I do mean the far worst, because I think he's going to be a good player. It's just like, he might have been a really great downfield college receiver with like 4.55 speed, because he's good at those other things like route running, you know, positioning, and, you know, how to bring your shoulder through against the guy covering you on this type of route and stuff like that, that, you know, makes the skill set bigger than like the athletic tools, basically. Whereas with Ridley, it's like, he just looks really, he looks like, you know, a fast and quick guy in SEC settings all the time. So it's just like, that would be surprising if it turned out he was actually, you know, not fast and not quick.
Yeah, that really would be. I mean, he's a guy that, you know, not just with his, I think his route running is as crisp as anyone else's in this class. And also, he's got an ability to run after the catch and to like generate separation late in his route, like right when he needs to. That's pretty impressive. So I think like on-field smarts is one of those things that I think gets a little bit underrated. And I think Ridley has that in a huge amount as well.
And then the race to be, if there's someone who's going to close in on those three, is probably Courtland Sutton, I would guess. But more realistically, Courtland Sutton, the big receiver from SMU.
He's going to screw himself.
I don't know. We'll see. I have no idea how to tell 40 time with some of these guys. And he's another one where it's, I can't look at the tape of Alshon Jeffrey and Dwayne Jarrett and really even tell you who's faster until we get to the combine.
Okay,
and
it's like, fair.
Yeah. But, Sutton, if he runs a 4.6 flat or better, I think he's locked into the top 45. If he runs like a 4.65, he probably falls into the third round. If he runs a 4.55, how is he not better than Mike Williams in that case? So it's like, there's a wide range of outcomes resting on his work at the combine. It could go very well for him or very badly, I think. And it's like, the margin isn't that big from that or the other. He was super productive in college. But yeah, I think he's probably the favorite to be the fourth receiver selected. If he isn't, it might be DJ Moore from Maryland. He's got a lot of favorable coverage right now among the public, and understandably so. He does good in highlights because he breaks tackles, runs past people after the catch.
Makes really
like
impressive end zone catches too. I mean, like, some of his stuff against Indiana, I want to say, like, was like kind of ridiculous circus catches against, you know, a decent Big Ten defense. But he also just had no quarterback play to speak of his entire time at Maryland from 2015 on. And this year, Maryland's first two quarterbacks tore their ACLs in the first 3 weeks of the season. And so he had this guy, this jokester, Max Bortenschlager, as his quarterback for, you know, the majority of this season. And Moore still put up, I think he led the Big Ten in receiving, even with that kind of dead weight.
He had over half of Maryland's receiving yardage, which could be from the coach just saying, like, to Bortenschlager, like, just throw it to Moore right away. Yeah. Or it could be because Moore was just the only one capable of basically working with that quarterback. We'll find out. I mean, I think my suspicion is he's pretty good, but the combine is pretty important for him. It's important for all these guys, but if Moore is slow, it's hard to see his impact as an after the catch, you know, separator. It would basically reduce him to like slot type work, which he could still be good at. It's just like, now you're not taking him in round two.
That might fit him more in the end anyway. I mean, considering that Moore is, you know, listed at 5'11", so maybe he's checking in a little bit closer to 5'10". That's a little bit tough to work with on the outside. Any other last thoughts before we wrap
up? The other day, two guys we got to keep a close eye on among the receivers. There's Equanimeous St. Brown from Notre Dame, had a down year coinciding with injury and a new quarterback. He might be like a Tyrell Williams type, but he needs to run well. There's DJ Chark, who had the big game at the Senior Bowl. He's really interesting. Dante Pettis, the punt returner from Washington. James Washington's teammate, Marcel Adaman, Oklahoma State. Big body like Courtland Sutton. And the reason you don't sign Jarvis Landry for $1 billion as a free agent is because you can get a guy like Trey Quinn out of SMU, probably in like the third or fourth round. But guys like that, Traquan Smith from UCF, Cedric Wilson from Boise State, Michael Gallup from Colorado State, Jordan Lastly from UCLA. I think those are the ones we're watching after the top four previously mentioned.
Yeah. And those are all combine guys, I'm pretty sure. And then one guy that didn't get a combine invite that I thought kind of deserved one was Doris Fountain.
He's like the Chad Williams of this draft, okay. I think. Like, I still think he's a good bet to go in the third or fourth round because the intel on him is he's supposed to test well at his pro day.
Okay, so there we go. So he's a guy that'll be missing from Indy, but a guy to, again, like stash in the back of your head. And like,
and we'll go deeper at that point for sure.
We absolutely will. So yeah, this one was more of just kind of a house cleaning to get the make some sense of what's happened to this point in the offseason.
Get our schedule started.
But we'll be getting more in depth at breaking down these draft prospects as these podcasts continue every single Wednesday here at RotoWire. For Mario Puig, I'm John McKechnie, and we will talk to you guys next week.